to the Ninja Lane podcast. In this episode, we talk about aftermarket heat sinks, Sandy Bridge memory, and our summer vacation. I am your host, Dennis Garcia, and with me today I have Darren McCain. So, Dennis, we've talked a lot in the last couple podcasts about my Sandy Bridge system and some of the stuff that I've looked at in building that. And as you know, I've finished it finally. So it's running great. A few learning experiences that you get with a new build. Yep. But one of the things that I discovered is we hadn't talked at all about aftermarket cooling and heat sinks. And that's kind of a big decision when you're building a system, especially when you're looking at a high-performance build. So I thought we could talk a little bit about heat sinks and some of the different technologies. What do you think?
Yeah, let's do that.
So maybe to start out, we can talk about some of my design decisions and some of the reasons that I chose an aftermarket heat sink. Now, I know that you don't ever use an OEM heat sink, and I don't either.
No, I have a huge box of them. I need to take them down and recycle them.
Yeah, and I think there are just a lot of different advantages to an aftermarket heat sink. When I was shopping, there were just a few factors that I was looking at. Of course, the first thing being the cost. I had kind of a set budget for my heat sink. It was nice that we ended up finding one in the shop that worked out. But when I was looking, cost was my primary factor. But I also found that the size and the aesthetic look of the heatsink were important too. And there are just so many out there in the OEM replacement market that it was a difficult decision to make. You know, can you tell us maybe what are some of the things in an OEM replacement? What are some of the benefits that you look for?
Okay, well, first, price should start with the OEM heatsink design. I mean, the one that comes with the processor is a small copper slugged radial fin, at least on the Intel side, radial fin design, right, with a single fan on top, and it just kind of clips down to the motherboard. AMD side is very similar, except that depending on what processor you get, it actually has a heat pipe design and a radiator, but it's still very compact.
Right.
The idea there is that it provides just enough cooling to give the processor a warranty.
I'm so honestly always amazed at how small they are in the box.
They are, and they're really quiet. They're relatively efficient, but they do get quite warm. And that's actually one of the benefits of going with an aftermarket design is that it's going to keep your system a lot cooler. You know, you look at some of the reviews that we have on Ninja Lane, the first portion of the review is always, you know, apples to apples. So I take the OEM heatsink and I look at the aftermarket heatsink, and we just do a basic heat test and heat capacity test.
That makes sense.
So it shows, you know, in a lot of cases, the OEM heatsink is 30 to 40 degrees hotter than this aftermarket design. And anytime you can have your system run cooler, it's going to last longer. It's going to run more stable under higher loads. And it, in most cases, it will give you a little bit of overclocking headroom.
So I noticed that the OEM heatsinks tend to echo the designs that I've been seeing for a long time. I mean, really back to the 939s and the P4s. And everything aftermarket these days tends to use a heat pipe. What are the advantages of the heat pipe?
The heat pipe allows you to move heat from a small, well, it basically moves heat from one area to another.
Right.
Now, the OEM designs, as I mentioned before, you know, they're a metal slug that sits over top of the, you know, and traditional heatsink hits over top of the heat source.
Sure.
Now, with a heat pipe, you can actually take and use a smaller chunk of metal over top of the processor, and then pipe that heat out to a much larger radiator. So instead of being limited to an 80 millimeter fan or a 60 millimeter fan over top of this little metal slug, you can have 120, 140 millimeter fan that's going to move more air and not have to spin as fast. So it's going to be a lot quieter.
Right.
And provide insanely better cooling. So, you know, with the heat pipe design, you can, you know, you're piping this heat out away from the processor really, really fast. I mean, it's almost instantaneous how fast this moves into a much larger radiator, and then it just dissipates and goes away.
So is there a right size?
Unfortunately, no. There's not a right size. No, there's a recommended size. You know, you look at some of these tower heat sinks that have, you know, they have four heat pipes, six heat pipes. They're going to have 120 millimeter fan front and back a lot of times, and they'll be able to handle like 200 watts of CPU power.
Okay.
Now, in every, you know, every retail processor on the market might be 130 watts if it's a Core 920, Core i7-920. And then, of course, you overclock that. It's going to be 4 to 4.2 gigahertz range. That's going to be about 200 watts. Right. You know, if you kick it up to 5 gigahertz, that works out to be about 300 watts, depending on how much voltage you need to send into the system. So, you know, these tower ones can just handle a lot more heat. And, you know, if you're playing a game, it's not going to be a constant load on the CPU. So it's going to go up and it's going to go down. And since these tower style heat pipe coolers can handle and move the heat really quick, it's going to keep the nominal temperature of the CPU a lot lower. Now, of course, the downside of that, as I mentioned, was a 120 millimeter fan is actually pretty big. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of cases have these on the side panels to move air out of the cases. Well, you're going to have a much larger case to handle one of these tower size coolers. It's not going to fit in one designed for a Pentium 4 or an Athlon XP 5-6 years ago. It's going to have to be one of the modern ones that's a little bit wider. So, you know, bigger heatsink, you're going to have a bigger case.
I've noticed there's been a big trend in moving into larger and larger fans, also in the cases, and that definitely helps explain that.
Yep.
Airflow is definitely good. Well, we've looked at a lot of heatsinks, both here at the lab and online, while we were making that decision. I thought maybe we could talk about some of our favorite heatsinks from the past, and then look at some of the more modern stuff. So I think probably the first OEM replacement heatsink that I was really proud of was the old Aerocool GT1000. And it's really a great, or maybe classic, example of the original tower. It had two heat pipes, or maybe a single on either side, and you could mount a 120 on either side. And it had a nice copper look to it, and they were actually pretty affordable. I don't know if you remember those.
Didn't it have a shroud around the whole thing, so it kind of directed the air through the radiator?
Yeah, exactly. That doubled as kind of a fan mount. They were tall, and they moved pretty decent heat. And one of the other reasons that I kept it around as long as I did is I put one in my first home theater build and discovered that with the processor I'd put in there, I could run it as a passive heatsink, which is just not really very common. No fan at all needed.
No.
That wasn't a really heavy load, but a nice looking heatsink under the window too.
Yeah, definitely. Now, that heatsink, what the processor platform did it support?
Well, that was back in the days of the 775. That was the last processor, I think, that it fit on. And it ran the gamut of AMD processors back in those days, too.
Okay, cool.
And after that, I remember getting excited about the Zalmans. If you remember the 9500s and the 9600s right in there. And that had a really different design that you don't see a lot these days. It had a kind of a round heatsink design that sat vertical. And I know that recently you did a couple of reviews on some orb styles like that.
Yeah, so, it was the Thermaltake spin cue designs.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, so I know that design's not entirely dead, but I remember mostly thinking that it just looked good. The 9500 also appealed to me because it was when I first started working on window cases, and it was the first really pretty heatsink I can remember with the copper that came with an LED light. And I just remember that just being so awesome.
Well, anytime you could have lights in your case without having to resort to a neon or a cold cathode or something like that was, you know, that was a bonus.
So what'd you run? What was your heatsink of choice back in the day?
Well, you know, back in the day on my main systems, I don't want to talk about those heatsinks because they were actually really noisy. But one of my favorites on the test bench was the Alpha PAL8150. And it was really the last huge Alpha, you know, the last huge heatsink that Alpha produced. You know, before that, it was on the Pentium 3 and the Athlon XP. You know, you had the 60 millimeter monsters that were on top. And,
right.
You know, that was the design where you would actually flip the fan over and pull air through the pins and then out the top. And it was actually a very unique way of handling the cooling. Whereas, you know, you had the Swiftex at the time and they said, well, you got to blow air down through the heatsink. But, you know, as we know now, the fans actually never directed air directly straight down. It always was down and out.
Right.
So it kind of, you know, it was a fan, but then it was also a big cone of air out the side. Mm-hmm. Now to get around that, you know, you flip the fan over and so you could pull air through the heatsink and, you know, the center of it would actually be pretty warm, but, you know, it progressively got colder out toward the edges.
Well, the other advantage of that design choice was the case fan actually worked better, the exhaust fan, at moving that air out, because you're pulling it from the central column, which was usually located at the same level.
Definitely. I mean, you know, in a lot of my case mods, I would enlarge the fan on the back right by the CPU just to pull out more air because of that. One of the other heat sinks that I recently, you know, I started using in my main system is the Thermalright Venomous X.
Oh, yeah. That's a good-looking heat sink.
Yeah, it's a pretty one. And, you know, if you were to use it as a weapon, you definitely could. It's got some sharp edges on there. But with the radiator design and the heat pipes, the pointier the edges are, ironically, the better they cool. Because you can, it's less, more surface area and... you know, you get more air around that. So you're always going to have these little sharp edges, and the more of them you have, the better it cools.
Well, it does make them fragile, but I've noticed that they stack them pretty densely now on some of these heat sinks too.
Yeah. Well, I've reviewed several of them, and you can tell which ones are made well and which ones aren't based on, you know, you just grab the radiator and kind of give it a little twist. And if it actually feels solid, then, you know, you can look, and a lot of times they're actually physically bound to the heat pipe. Whereas some of the other ones are just holes drilled in there and the heat pipes slide through and the radiator itself is actually interlocked. So, You know, and it's one of those subtlety things that you really have to look at it really close to know the way it's built and actually the interface between the radiator and heat pipe. Because, you know, and this was one of the discussions a long time ago, especially around the time of the Alphas, was, you know, they started using hybrid designs where the center of it was copper and then the outer portion of it was aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
And people would actually be scrutinized by how those two metals were bonded because you can't physically weld them together. You have to kind of press them together and, you know, and do some magic gluing or something. I'm not sure exactly how it worked, but, you know, at the same time, they were experimenting with thin fin designs.
Right.
And it was how it was bonded to the base. So some of them were welded, and some of them were just kind of pushed in there. So,
well, I noticed that on the test bench today, you were also working with the Cooler Master V6.
That is actually a fun heat sink, not because it really cools very well, because, you know, it's kind of an average, but it comes with two fans from the factory and a fancy little... you know, it's a radiator cap, for the lack of another term. But when you press the button, it changes the LED color.
Oh, fancy.
So, you know, of course, you got to plug separate power in for that because the, you know, the fans themselves are 4-pin, so they plug into the motherboard headers and can be controlled thermally that way. An interesting point, after I reviewed that heatsink, you know, you'd see other sites reviewing the same thing, and, you know, their review methodologies were a lot different than mine. And in some cases, they said, well, you know, to have... you know, an equal test bench across the board, we're going to use the same fan when we review these tower heat sinks. Well, Cooler Master had actually designed a special fan that would, instead of blowing the air out into this cone that we talked about earlier,
right,
it actually pushed the air in. So it wouldn't actually move the same amount of air. Well, I mean, it's the same surface area, but it actually directed the air more straight through the heat sink, so you didn't have to have fan shrouds on the side. And by using the fans that were included with the design, it cooled better than if you actually switched it to a much, like a high pressure fan or a high speed fan, or even, you know, put a blower motor in there. You know, these fans were actually designed for the heatsink, and a lot of reviewers were totally disregarding that and changing it to whatever they wanted. You know, that's another thing to think of when you're looking at heatsinks is like, you know, look at the fans. And, you know, and realize that in some cases, especially with reputable designers, they put these fans on there for a reason. And, you know, if the fan dies, then you might have to get rid of the entire heatsink because you can't replace them.
I know the only time I've ever really replaced the fan from what was included was when sound was the primary issue as opposed to cooling. And then I'd go with something like a Noctua aftermarket fan where your primary goal really is silence in the PC.
Yeah. And, you know, we're both, we've been in this long enough that we actually know about the Delta Screamer and why saying that little catchphrase is actually kind of brings, you know, a cringe to the system builder. So, you know, I'm actually glad nowadays that we're using these bigger fans to actually spin a lot slower, but yes, are more efficient in actually blowing air through and keeping the heatsink cool. So,
yeah, nothing like sounding like a jet engine firing up when you start your PC.
Yeah. Now, when you were building your P67,
mm-hmm,
you know, I said, hey, you know, get rid of that OEM. We're not going to use that.
Of course.
And I said, you know, go out into the lab and just kind of pick one. So which one did you actually settle on?
Well, you know, I ended up with Coolink's Corator DS. It's a pretty massive tower with a single fan solution.
Yeah. And the unique thing about that cooler is that it's actually, instead of a single radiator, it's two radiators. Mm-hmm. So, you know, normally that you have this really long heat pipe that loops through and the center of it is right over the processor. Well, both of those go on either side of the radiator, on one's on the right or on the left. Well, right. With the CoolLink, they did twin towers. So you have air coming in the first tower and there's a fan in the middle and then it goes out the back tower. Well, that's one side of the heat pipe and then the other side of the heat pipe.
Yeah, and there's actually a different density too. So the fins that are on the pulled side, if you will, that the air is pulled across, are much denser than the other side, which helps make up for the airflow.
Yeah, I really love that heatsink. Part of it was, you know, they used much larger heat pipes, mm-hmm. so they can move a lot more heat. It's a little bit more heat capacity without having to resort to adding six heat pipes, for instance, or eight heat pipes. Now, I know you noticed the base of that heatsink.
Yeah, in the past I've had some pretty fancy heatsinks that I've had a chance to look at or work with where the heat pipes had direct contact, which is great, but there was a lot of gap space because the pipes themselves were just flattened to make contact and there wasn't a full contact surface. But the Corator fixes that by including a full block. So you're getting really complete coverage.
Yeah. When I talked to them at Computex about that heatsink specifically, it was a special manufacturing process that they went through to make it so that the bottom was flat and still give you that core contact design.
Right.
And for the lack of not knowing what that method is, I almost mm-hmm. would think that they're taking those heat pipes and dipping them in liquid copper to go and fill in the gaps and then mm-hmm. grinding it smooth. But who knows?
Well, we've seen some evolution in that method. And a good example of that is the Cooler Master Hyper, the 212, because I've used two different versions of it now, one that had some gappage and one that didn't. So they're definitely evolving in that direction.
Yeah, well, I think when people complain about having to use a lot of extra thermal paste and then not having it actually work, mm-hmm. it kind of resonates up the chain.
Absolutely. And, you know, the design is not that much different to get the extra efficiency that you need.
So we've talked about standard heat pipe coolers. That's really just aftermarket replacement. But there's several designs that were implemented that are actually gone now that kind of combine technologies.
Well, I remember for a while, the do-it-yourselfers were really excited about the promise of the Peltier coolers and using those as heat distribution devices. And that train of thought really led to some fun hybrid coolers that used a combination of, you know, heat fins, Peltiers, and sometimes even water cooling in a closed ecosystem, if you will.
Yeah. Well, enthusiasts have been using Peltiers on, you know, for overclocking for a long time now.
Right.
And a lot of guys that would use these things would just hook up a separate power supply and then run an insanely large Peltier on their CPU and then, you know, have a water cooling loop on there to cool it. Danger Den was actually, that was part of the reason they got their start, was they were offering up the, you know, water blocks to cool this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But then, you know, you see other guys just with like this huge monster air cooler on top of there mm-hmm. and, you know, 12 different fans. Really, at that point, all they cared about was just keeping the heatsink cool because the Peltier was actually doing all the work.
That's right. You know, there wasn't really ever much of a selection. I mean, because they're kind of expensive, took a lot of power.
Yeah.
It was a lot to go wrong.
There's a lot of moving parts, that's for sure.
So, you know, I remember I picked up at one point an Ultra Chiltec, which was probably the first what I would call hybrid cooler. It was a monster heat sink with the heat pipes and two fans, and it had a breakout control box that just looked sexy. But the actual cooler itself was just so large, I felt like it was going to bow the heat sink sometimes when it was in there. It's just big, heavy thing.
Yeah, and it was following one of the enthusiast designs, really.
It really was.
So, you know, you'd, and correct me, because I actually have never really used this, but it had a metal base and then the Peltier and then this monster cooler on top of it, right?
Exactly. So I had, I want to say four heat pipes, although it's been a while since I've used it. And the enclosure itself was probably a good 6 or 8 inches long and 4 inches square fins, with a nice aluminum-looking cover and a fan at both sides to pull the air across it. And, you know, you could actively monitor the temperature via the front screen, which was nice. and it would tell you whether it was working or not, which at the time was really the biggest problem you had with your Peltiers, is they would go out and there was no way you could tell.
No. Well, I guess maybe your fans would start spinning faster because there was more power available, but, you know.
Now, I know you've had some experience with the Cooler Master products, and I think most recently you guys worked with the V10, and I haven't had a chance to use that, but what were your thoughts on that?
You know, I didn't physically get to use the V10. One of the other reviewers looked at it, and he actually had troubles with it. And it was one of those things where, you know, the cooler was huge. It had two fans on it, you know, and it mimicked that Ultra design in terms of size.
Mm-hmm. And I remember it was really large. And it had kind of an interesting shape to it, too.
Yeah, well, yeah, it was. It was kind of big, and it was just the shape of the radiators. And it was really two separate heat pipe loops. So you had one loop that was multi-heat pipes that had the two fans on it, and that was really the primary cooling loop.
Right.
And as a supplement to get things moving, because as we know, heat pipes work on a temperature differential. So the you have a hot side and a cold side,
right,
and basically the heat moves to the cold side. So the idea was to add a Peltier to the secondary loop with just a couple of heat pipes on it to give that an extremely cold side.
Oh, so it didn't have direct contact with the actual processor at all?
No, it didn't. It tried to pull a little excess heat off of the system and plug it into that Peltier, and then there was the hot side of that Peltier contacted the primary heat pipe loop. The two 120s that were on there would actually go and cool the hot side of the Peltier while the cold side of it was actually cooling the processor. Now, that was a secondary portion of the loop, and that was really the problem because that Peltier was only like 10 or 20 watts. It was really small.
Okay.
You know, you have a 130-watt processor on here, you overclock it a bit, it's going to saturate that entire system. And pretty soon the Peltier is just going to be, you know, in a hot cycle, and it's going to be dumping heat back into the system instead of cooling it like it should.
Now, I know that's a real danger with the Peltier, and I've seen some systems that handle that via an external radiator or even an internal radiator. And that brings me to actually probably my favorite company for hybrids, which is Coolit. And Coolit had, for quite a while, a line of, hybrid processors that used your rear exhaust fan as a mounting. So they would take a water cooling system through a water block on the processor, pump that up into a radiator system that would use a series of Peltiers and a rear exhaust fan to remove the heat. Now, the Free Zone was probably my favorite, and then to a lesser extent, the Eliminator. Now, I know that they don't make those products anymore, but they're now using a more simplified version, the ALC series. And I'm wondering if it's just the added complexity that's led them back to that simple design.
Well, the way I understand it from Coolit, their system was more than just that, you know, a water chiller, which is really what they've designed.
Well, that's a good way of putting it.
So they had monitoring software that would allow you to adjust the water temperature. So you could have a constant water temperature going to the water block. So if you wanted to have it at 10 degrees, or if you wanted to have it 20 degrees, or you want to have it 0 degrees, you would just dial in more power to these Peltiers. Well, the problem with the Peltier, the enthusiasts a long time ago knew this, you really need a lot of power to make those things work efficiently.
Yes, you
do. You know, they would have two Molexes that would just plug into your standard power supply. So you were really limited to how much power you could supply to those Peltiers. And, you know, let's face it, the Core i7-920, you know, it's a 130-watt processor, you know, at normal clocks. That would actually saturate these old Free Zones and the Eliminator systems just because you don't have that much wattage on those Peltiers to keep the water cool.
Mm-hmm.
So while it was great while it lasted and worked awesome on 775 systems, I just don't think that they could keep up with, you know, the advances in processor technology.
Well, it's interesting to see that whole train of thought basically moving to the side for the heat pipe design. I think there's any chance that we'll see those hybrid systems again?
Yeah, I think that they might come back. You know, they're really complex, so there's, you know, it would be a real gamble for a cooling company to come up with them. But, you know, the Sandy Bridge, that's a 95-watt processor. That's, you know, back in the range of the 775 series. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can get two or three Peltiers in there. And, you know, let's face it, 1,200 watt power supply, you got plenty of power at that point, depending on how many video cards you're wanting to run.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So, you know, you could still have a self-contained water chiller. And, you know, if you really just wanted to have a water cooler, you know, you turn off the Peltiers and you just run through a dual fan radiator or something like that. At that point, it kind of gives you a choice. You know, what do you want to do?
Well, with cases these days coming more and more designed for external radiators and coolers of all types, I could easily see a hybrid system even with an external Peltier chiller. I mean, who knows?
Well, you know, if you go external, you could have, you know, say you get a laptop power supply or a couple of them, or even a custom one that just plugs into the wall.
Right.
At that point, the power is separate from your system. So you could have, you know, your core, whatever you want to run, and a couple of video cards and three or four hard drives, you know, your enthusiast system, and then pipe a couple of tubes out the back into this external cooler that would actually be, you know, the pump and the radiator and your fans. Well, it could also have a water chiller component too that would just spin off some of the water and kind of circulate it and cool it independently. That could be Peltier controlled or even a small phase or something like that.
Right.
And at that point, you just plug that into another wall outlet, another wall socket, and you could have as much power as you needed.
Yeah, the possibilities on that are really limitless.
Definitely. And, well, the only limit is size at that point.
Dennis, I know that recently we've done a lot of memory reviews, and on the front page right now we have a couple of really nice G-Scale Ripjaw X reviews, and the memory is very similar, which I think puts us in a really unique opportunity to compare two of the PC-17000 memory module sets and talk about some of the performance differences in the cache and, well, in the performance numbers in general for Sandy Bridge.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons that these two reviews are so unique and so interesting is because they're the same speed, they're the same size, they're from the same company, and the only major difference is the timings. It's kind of unique in that, you know, there's two schools of thought in terms of memory. There's, you know, the old school and, you know, the Sandy Bridge school.
Right.
Is the way I'm going to put it. So, you know, kind of the old school way of thinking was, you know, timings are really important.
And that's what I'm used to.
And, you know, the reason being was, you know, on these older systems when, you know, the memory controller was in the chipset, timings were at a premium because the memory speed itself, the memory frequency, was considerably slower.
Right.
You know, it would max out at DDR was like 400 or 500, and then DDR2 was a little bit faster, and DDR3 was a little bit faster. You know, on X58, 1600 megahertz was, you know, the nominal speed. You could buy 2000 megahertz memory. You know, I had a set of Corsair Dominator GTs, really good timings, really good speeds, 2000 megahertz. Worked awesome for overclocking, so I wouldn't have to actually downclock the memory clock. And that would actually give me a lot of benefits in, you know, in gaming performance and actually in benchmarking because of the lower timings and the lower latency. Well, with Sandy Bridge, you know, things had kind of changed. You know, there was a big shift from, you know, just raw bandwidth from like the triple channel of the X58 versus the dual channel of the Sandy Bridge.
Right.
And, you know, that shift was speed, you know, 1600 megahertz versus, you know, 2133 megahertz. And, you know, some of the initial reviews would have, you know, my X58 Core i7-920 running at 1600 megahertz at a certain speed. And then you get a Sandy Bridge system running at, you know, 1866 or 2133. And it just tromped all over it in terms of, you know, it had a dual channel memory controller versus a triple channel memory controller. And it's just kind of a different school of thought in the way that, you know, the different architectures were done.
So it's really all about the memory controller, not the number of channels?
Basically, yes. The memory controller in the Sandy Bridge is, you know, I don't know the particulars from it because I'm not a processor engineer, but, you know, they were able to extract a lot of efficiency from the Sandy Bridge memory controller that just wasn't there in the Halem architecture.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the G-Skill stuff. So we are looking at two nearly identical modules. Well, what's the difference between the two?
The difference is the timings. You know, we have the black modules are at cast 7, which, you know, us enthusiasts, you know, we're looking at cast 7 because that's, you know, that's really tasty. That's going to be our fastest module.
Right.
And that's just kind of, you know, that's ingrained because, you know, we came up, you know, running these older systems and, you know, we need to have the best performing memory. Well, the other modules, which are the blue ones, they run at a lower voltage and they're at cast 9. So they're kind of a green module. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you run the benchmarks and you look at the charts that are actually in the review and they're almost identical.
I noticed that and it's got me really wondering, why would I want to spend a little bit more money and what does my extra money get me?
Well, it's kind of an interesting question because, you know, if you look at the gaming performance, we threw in Crysis as one of our gaming benchmarks when looking at these different modules. And the frame rates are almost identical across the board. You know, it's same CPU speed, same memory speed. So you don't really get a lot in everyday apps. So, you know, this Cast 9 running at higher speeds is a lot better. That's not to say that the Cast 7 doesn't have some advantages because, you know, if you look at the actual latency and, you know, one of the Sonder benchmarks, you know, you have higher memory bandwidth and then you also have lower latency. So anytime you run a calculation that latency is a big issue in that, the Cast 7 is going to win out, obviously.
So when we look at Sandy Bridge in particular, it really is just about the megahertz.
Yep, it is. for the lack of saying it another way, it really is just about the megahertz and the frequency. You know, if you're one of the other memory reviews that we did was some Patriot modules running at 1866. Now, those are actually included as a reference module in these reviews, and you can clearly see that, you know, there's a 6,000 megahertz or 6,000 megabits of speed difference in the actual latency bandwidth. But then you look at the Crysis benchmarks, and, you know, the numbers are about the same. You know, Crysis is actually more about CPU speed and video card than it is about memory. But that's just because, you know, we have enough memory in the system that it's not going to have to move a lot in and out to actually do the calculations for the game.
So I'm looking at the cost factor between these two modules, well, and all of the G-Skill modules in the Ripjaw X series. And I'm seeing that, I mean, there are really a lot of G-Skill modules at every price point. So when we look at cost, it looks like we're looking at speed first, then timings, then voltage.
G-Skill kind of set up their pricing based on, you know, the quality of the module, which is really kind of the smart way to do it.
Okay.
Take, for instance, the blue modules, the blue G-Skill modules in the review. Those are 2133 modules at Cast 9. You know, they come with a cooling fan that goes and attaches to the top of them to keep them cool. You know, those modules are $100. That's a $100 kit right there.
Okay. And that's the fan and everything.
And that's the fan and everything. You know, and then we move up to the Cast 7, which is actually, it's going to be the premium modules. But the major difference there is to get to the Cast 7 rating, they had to increase the voltage.
Okay.
So, you know, if I pull off the heat spreaders, these chips are probably going to be from the same bin. They're going to be, you know, virtually identical. But to make them run at Cast 7, you know, they tweaked some of the subtimings and then increased the voltage. And it was able to drop that speed down and actually make them just that much more faster. You know, and that comes at a price premium of an extra $40. You know, that's what, $140 versus $100. As an enthusiast, I would probably go after the Cast 7 modules, but that's just because I'm going to be using these things to run benchmarks. I'm going to be trying to get the fastest SuperPi score.
Right.
You know, and I suppose there's going to be a little bit of a gain if you're, you know, doing a lot of audio ripping or if you're going to be, you know, doing some video editing or something like that.
Well, I remember when I was last looking for enthusiast RAM and on the X58 and, well, all the way back even to when my Q66 was the king, we were really looking at the timings and focusing on trying to get the lowest and most consistent timings as our first priority.
On the X58 and even before that, the timings were really important, but that was just because the memory controller was so much slower. And it wasn't actually as efficient, so you really needed to have more efficient memory modules to get the data in and out as quickly as possible.
So from an enthusiast standpoint, you still want to get the fastest speed with the lowest latency and lowest voltage, but your primary concern there is just the overhead for clocking.
Definitely. You know, in terms of clocking, I was able to take these 2133, you know, the blue modules in this review.
Right.
I was able to run those at 2300 megahertz and just by, you know, adding some base clock to it. You know, I think I was running 108 on my 2600K. Mm-hmm. So that would, you know, translated into a 2300 megahertz frequency. I was able to zip through benchmarks.
Now that just seems so backwards to me.
Well, it's kind of a new way of thinking about it. I mean, speed really is the premium now. So you're going to want to find the fastest module you can. Timings aren't that important. So if you can find a really fast module at Cas 9, it's going to perform as well as, you know, a similar module at Cas 7.
Okay.
At least in the real world. Now, if you're going to be doing, you know, memory, calculation intensive, where it's going to be sending stuff to system memory and back, you know, latency is going to be a big factor there. But for games and for, you know, surfing the web, stuff like that, it's not going to be that big of a deal. So, you know, as enthusiasts, you might want to save a few bucks and you know, get the Cas 9 stuff, feed it a little extra voltage, and you might be able to drop the timings down.
That's not a bad tip at all. Well, looking forward to the future and some of these new platforms that Intel's been talking about, I know that there's discussion of going into 4 memory channels.
Yeah, that's the rumored 2111 socket that, you know, if you look at the specs and you know a little bit about Sandy Bridge, you can kind of tell that it really seems like they're taking 2 Sandy Bridge processors, putting them on the same die, and going to build a processor out of that.
Now, that would make sense. 2 channels to 4, 2 processors.
Definitely. Well, and, you know, 2111, that's, you know, almost double what the 1155 socket is. So it kind of seems like just a dual CPU system on a single chip. I personally think it's going to be awesome, especially since Intel's going to be unlocking the overclocking control. So base clock is going to have a bigger factor in overclocking. You know, right. You'll be able to stop the system clock, so it's not going to increase you know, your PCI Express bus, and it's going to, you know, it won't kill network cards when you're overclocking anymore. So,
well, if they can keep the heat under control, I think it's going to be something to look forward to.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. It really can't come fast enough.
Hey, Dennis, spring is in the air, and it's got me thinking about traveling, and I know it's that time of year for you as well. What trips are coming up?
Well, let's see. First week of June is Computex in sunny Taipei, Taiwan.
Wow, now that is definitely a trip.
Yeah, let's see. From here, it is 2 hours to California, and then 12 hours over the Pacific Ocean, nonstop, you know, because I'm going nonstop. None of this stopping in Tokyo or anything like that. Nonstop to Taipei, and then, you know what, there's an hour and 10-minute cab ride to the hotel, and then several hours for me to catch up on some sleep.
I can imagine. Now, you definitely pay extra for the big seat, I bet.
Yeah. My first time to Computex, that was, what, 2003. I went on the cheap. I paid, you know, as little as possible, because it was kind of a big deal for me. You know, mm-hmm. First time out of the country, at least needing a passport. So I bought the coach seat, and I was in the middle, and everyone hates in the middle.
Oh, no.
And, well, I have this, I don't know, I can't sleep on a plane. So, you know, I was up for the entire 12 hours trying to watch a movie, which, you know, in the coach, the movie screen, the TV screen is actually in the aisle all the way at the front. So, you know, you couldn't really see anything, and I had there was Japanese business guy to my right, and then there was like this really small Chinese girl to my left. My only saving grace was that the exit row was right behind me. So about, 4 hours into the trip, after we had dinner and everyone fell asleep, I went and crawled off the back, and then I would walk around the plane.
Hey, well, that'll keep you busy at least. Now, this is number 7?
Yeah, I have to, let's see, click. Yeah, this is my 7th trip.
So I know this time you've been doing a lot of planning, picked up some new toys, so you're deep in the preparations. What do you got going on?
Well, in the previous years, I have always gone to the show, had my meetings, and then I go back to the hotel, and, I'd write up my day's activities and post something on the site. Well, as I've learned over the years, there's parties that happen after hours.
Right.
And I have gotten invited to a lot of those, and some of them are actually my own. So, there isn't a lot of time after hours to get any work done. So one of my changes this year is I'm going to try to do live updates from the show floor. There's always time in between meetings. I might go and talk to someone for 15 minutes, take some pictures, and then I'm left walking around for an hour and a half until my next meeting starts. So I bought myself an Asus tablet. It's the Core i5 one, super awesome. I'm planning to do a review of that, actually.
Very nice.
And the idea is that I will just carry that around, because it's about the size of a netbook, and it's about the same weight. So I'll just carry that around with me, and as I find something cool and exciting, I can actually pull the memory card out of the camera, put it in the tablet, go and resize it, do a little news post or blog post, and then upload it to the site, and then I can move on.
I know. I always look forward to the pictures and the blogging that you've done in the past. So getting real-time updates is actually going to be something I'm really looking forward to.
Yeah, well, it's going to be new for me, too, because I've actually never done that. Even at CES, I wait until I get back to the hotel to actually do updates. And in some cases, depending on how tired I am or, if I went out with some friends or something like that, like 1 year, I didn't do any updates until after I got home.
What about Facebook and Twitter?
I do plan to be doing some updates through Facebook and Twitter, probably Facebook more often than Twitter. So if you're actually following Ninja Lane on Facebook, you can get the update dates that way. I'm also going to be doing some blogging on the website as my pre-show planning, and that will be up until my trip and then actually during the show. I'm also having some new shirts made up. Every year I go and have a different logo design put on some shirts, and I take that with me. And some of them I give away, but most of the time I just kind of, I want to feel official, walk around in some Ninja Lane swag.
Yeah.
And when I get those back from the t-shirt shop, I always take some pictures and post them in the forum. So if anyone is interested in picking some up, just drop me a PM and with your size, and I'll let you know how much that will be.
Terrific. Well, I definitely am looking forward to it, and more on that to come.
For more information on the topics in this podcast, please consult our show notes. And if you have questions on anything that we did discuss, please drop by the forums at forums.ninjalane.com. You can follow Ninja Lane on Twitter and Facebook, or subscribe to our RSS feed. This has been a Ninja Lane production, copyright 2011. Thanks for joining. This has been a Ninja Lane production, copyright 10,000.